I mean,
some of the scenes you will witness may appear to border on fantasy.
I can game it in a big way.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Yes, yes.
But
I mean,
tonight we care, and it shows.
The law.
You will listen and obey.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Edition of Media Monarchy. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster and web slinger. It's November 17th, 2006. It's good to be back. I missed last week. A lot of stuff going on. Moved to a new apartment. Didn't have internet. So I was away from the news and media that I so deeply crave, and I hope you do too. Media Monarchy is here every Friday from 10 a.m. until noon. And you can also go to mediamonarchy.blogspot.com for all the news and views and videos and tons more that you're going to hear on this show. I missed last week, so missed election and Saddam and all kinds of things, all the police state measures, all the news that's fit to suppress. So I got a lot of stuff to get into this week. You're going to hear anything about the Carlyle Group and tons more, Iraq for sale. But to kick it off right, let's get into Fugazi.
Thank you.
Truck driving was a fun thing for him. He enjoyed it. He was told and convinced that he would be safe.
They all had driven trucks and were truck drivers before they went over there.
I went to make a better life for my family.
We were told he would not be sent into any areas of known danger.
I trusted the company.
They told us, well, you won't have to worry. You have plenty of protection. Guaranteed $140,000 in 9 months. Anything that sounds too good to be true usually is.
Can the Secretary of Defense, can the Vice President, can this administration take the military to war to feed the greed of contractors?
We've employed corporations, private entities, to carry out inherent government functions.
They should not be using civilians for combat operations.
A corporation is going to put human needs on the bottom if it conflicts with profit.
Basic safety precautions weren't taken.
Forcing them to go out and to drive into battle zones.
They cut corners left and right.
No sharpshooters, no escorts, no flak vests, no helmets.
No armor. No weapons.
No rear gunner. No armored vehicles, not even a map.
It's just wrong.
God damn!
Jesus Christ. God help us all, Lord.
Value on human life.
They're willing to sacrifice people.
Is there any way around it, guys?
That's a trailer for Iraq for Sale, The War Profiteers, and that's the new documentary from Robert Greenwald and Brave New Films, the guys that brought you Unconstitutional, Outfoxed, Walmart, and tons of other great documentaries. That, first off, I'll tell you, is going to be showing here in Portland Sunday night at Performance Works Northwest, Sunday night at 7, and it's also available on DVD, and you can hit the links on my webpage. It's available from the Disinformation Corporation. The webpage I just mentioned is MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com, and you're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.com, and you can also hit us up on the phone at 503-22-BLAST, and you can hit me up with an email at MediaMonarchy@Yahoo.com. Iraq for Sale, The War Profiteers is a documentary about the ongoing Iraq war and the behavior of companies with no-bid contracts working within Iraq. The movie was made by Robert Greenwald and Brave New Films. The movie criticizes the perceived greed, waste, and ineffectiveness of the contractors in a war that has been privatized by corporations on a historic level. Specifically, the film claims contractors are overbilling the government and doing substandard work while endangering the lives of American soldiers and private citizens. The documentary contends these major four companies are composed of ex-military and ex-government workers who unethically help these companies get and keep enormous contracts and milk the American taxpayer. The companies criticized are Blackwater, KBR Halliburton, CACI, and Titan. Now, you can watch the movie on Google Video. I've got the entire movie posted up on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. I implore you to watch it, and I've also got an interview with the director, Robert Greenwald, that was run on the Conscious Media Network, and you can go to consciousmedianetwork.com for this and tons of other interviews. So now we're going to listen to Robert Greenwald on the Conscious Media Network.
We've all heard of the profiteering involved in war. In short, war is good business for those in the power elite. The war in Iraq is no exception. Film producer Robert Greenwald has pulled together a portrait of the degree to which this war has been conducted to profit those closest to those in power, and the profits are staggering. Try the $45 per six-pack of Coke the government pays the services contractor, or the $100 to do a load of the soldiers' skivvies, and that's only small potatoes compared to the rest of what's detailed in the film Iraq for Sale.
felt that if we could do the movie and do it reasonably quickly, come the fall, when we're in the election campaign, we could use the film to force a debate about war profiteering. This was in January, it's now September, and we were able to get it done on an insane schedule. And hopefully now it's doing what it needs to do, which is people are taking it, they're screening it, they're organizing it, and they're using it to ask questions about what's going on with war profiteering, who's protecting me, and who's not protecting me.
If we can get into a little bit, how did this story, what revealed itself to you in the process of researching this subject, and get into the meat and bones of it a little bit?
Well, as we started the research, I was sure that there would be some troubling facts and figures. What I didn't really focus on is that profiteering is not a victimless crime. It's not a white-collar crime which kind of just goes out into the environment and you don't know how it's affecting anybody. People's lives are being lost. And in the movie, we have truck drivers whose best friends were killed in Iraq because Halliburton was cutting corners to make a bigger profit. The head of Halliburton has made over $100 million in his stock since the war began. We have mothers whose sons were killed at Fallujah because Blackwater was trying to save money and doing things they shouldn't have done. And we have interrogators at Abu Ghraib talking about the fact they were hired by Khaki, a for-profit company, and sent into Abu Ghraib to make profit. The head of Khaki made $20 million. Those were things I had no idea about, and I was troubled and shocked, and it was painful because the people's lives are being lost.
And it's not, we're not just talking about mercenaries. I think even when the war first began, there were stories about people who went over in a more mercenary fashion, you know, bold men to make a profit, knowing what they were getting into. This is not exactly what we're talking about here, is it?
No, what we're focused on in the movie is the corporations, the boards of directors, the heads of the corporations who are leading the charge to profit from the war, at the very same time that men and women, Americans, Iraqis, children are being killed and hospitals are not being built, these companies are taking hundreds of millions and literally billions of dollars out of Iraq and into their private coffers. That's wrong, and there's been no discussion of it.
Right, very little discussion. And what, can you give us an example of a couple of different people that were induced into this civilian position in this war zone? Specifics, a couple specifics.
Well, there's a truck driver in the movie, guy I just love, I haven't met him, it's just been on the phone, named Shane. And he talks about going over there to help his family, to do the right thing, to rebuild Iraq, to help the troops. Goes to work for Halliburton, truck driver, just driving a truck in some city in the United States.
So he thinks he's part of the good effort.
Yeah. And he gets over there and he discovers that, and I didn't believe this when I first heard it, Halliburton's charging you and everybody watching this, because it's our tax dollars, $45 for a six-pack of Coke.
You are kidding. I've heard of these exorbitant prices, $45 for a six-pack.
Right, and we heard that over and over and over again. And then a soldier and several other Halliburton truck drivers talk about sending their laundry out, T-shirts, underwear, $100. Now, all of that comes out of your pocket because these contracts are what's called cost-plus contracts. So it means what it means is that whatever the cost is, Halliburton gets that money plus a built-in profit based on the size of the contract, which means the more you spend, the more profit you make. So there's absolutely no inducement or incentive or reason for them to spend less. In fact, there's reason to spend more.
So how would you cost plus a six-pack of Coke up to $45?
Well, Halliburton is run by a former Enron accountant, so a guy from Arthur Anderson, which helps explain some of that. It's pretty staggering.
It is staggering. But there has to be a solid and tempting inducement for the people that do volunteer or are hired by the corporations to go over there? What's the story they're told while they're still here before they go to Iraq?
Well, first of all, they're told they'll be safe. Well, they have been told. One of the reasons I hope the people will screen the film all over is we have to break that mythology down. People have to know how dangerous it is. And second of all, we are at a time in the United States where it's tragic, but a truck driver has to go to Iraq to make a living, to pay for his health care, or to put his children through school. That's a tragedy of the worst kind. And again, like in the Walmart movie, we're looking at a system. We're not looking at individual crooks. We're looking at a system of profit, large corporations that give money to politicians, that hire former military, high-level military and politicians, and as a result are getting significant contracts and making millions and ultimately billions of dollars.
So how much are they inducing, how much are they offering to these people to do a truck driving job? I assume it's for a tour of duty, for a few months or a set period of time?
Well, it's variable. It depends on what trucks you're in, what part of the country it is. But the things that the soldiers told me over and over again is that they would be working right next to somebody who would be doing exactly the same job as the soldier. And that person would be getting three and four times what the soldier made. And again, your tax dollars are paying for that.
So it's a significant amount of money to be a truck driver.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
So they're tempted into going over for all the obvious reasons, to take care of their families and so forth. They get there and they're promised that this is a civilian job. You will not be in any particular danger. Give us a couple of examples where that was not the case.
We have a story in the film called The Friday Massacre where these truck drivers talk about the fact there were two of them who survived, and actually there were four of them who survived. Two of them are in the movie. And they tell the story of getting up and driving that day down a road that had been closed, that had been marked dangerous, but Halliburton pushed it because they get paid by the number of trips. By the way, they don't have to deliver anything. They just have to take trips. So we even had truck drivers tell us about driving virtually empty trucks across Iraq because the billing procedure rewards Halliburton for that.
That's criminal.
Yeah, and in this particular case, Friday Massacre, we have the women whose husbands were killed in that massacre because Halliburton did not abide by any kind of safety rules or regulations, and there was no protection or very little protection. And they were driven, as corporations are, to maximize dollars. We all have had the experience. We all know what large corporations do, whether it's cutting a job or, you know, eliminating a function or having less expensive goods. Corporations are driven to maximize profit. Well, when you do that in the war, people are going to die, and people are dying as a result of that.
And they can get away with it, I'm assuming, because outside of films like this, they're really out of harm's way. I mean, they're out of the view of the camera because everything is so heavily censored in terms of what comes out in the evening news, for example. How was this working within the system? How did you get the video and also I assume a lot of the interviews you must have gotten after they had returned. Mm-hmm. How did this work in gathering the information when it is so heavily censored?
Well, it was a challenge finding the people, but people who'd been through some of these horrific experiences, many of them wanted to be able to talk about it, for some good to come out of it. So we spent a lot of time and a lot of energy reaching out, and there's been some great reporting, actually. T. Christian Miller, who writes for the L.A. Times, done some great stories, and he has a brilliant book out called Blood Money. James Glantz, I think it is, who writes for the New York Times. So there's been a few reporters that I'm aware of who've done really good work on this. But it's one of those issues that needs the dots connected so that you don't just read an individual story about one contract for Halliburton where they overcharge the government, but you look at the pattern and you understand the causes. You understand it's a cost-plus contract, and you understand that they have given millions of dollars to political candidates each year. They spend millions of dollars on lobbyists. And so the dots start to connect.
And we hear this, we've heard it throughout time also, not just in war profiteering, but like NASA, where you pay $2,000 for a toilet seat. But we think, well, that's high tech. I mean, gravity's a little different up there. Okay, we can bite that one, but $45 for Coke?
Six pack,
excuse me. I hate to think it would have been
Coke.
Otherwise, it would have been a few hundred dollars. How has this been received with the media at large, stirring this up, which is, by the way, congratulations for stirring it up. How has the media been receiving it? Have you been getting much media?
We have, actually. It's been, the film doesn't take a political position in the sense of political party or whether you're even against or in favor of the war. There are Republicans in the film, there are conservatives in the film, but by design. And while the primary media is never looking to focus on the serious issues for the most part, it's no fault of the journalist. The system is there to maximize dollars, and therefore the pressure is on the news to, you know, do somebody having a baby rather than some of the major issues of the day. But having said that, we've had ABC National News did a 2-minute piece on the film and profiteering last week. This week I'll be doing many of the cable shows. The Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, and other papers have done pretty major pieces. So I think we have an opportunity to do what we want to do with the film, which is get people talking, get a debate going, and because the films are distributed alternatively, every time there's a screening, there's a discussion afterwards about what to do. And that's a big difference than going to the movie theater, which I love, and we're also in the movie theaters. But what happens after the movie theater, your primary concern is getting rid of the plastic cup that you drank your Diet Coke from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here the primary concern is, what are you going to do? Are you going to write a letter? Are you going to make a phone call? Are you going to go sit in at an office? Are you going to join Amnesty International? What is the action you will take? And we're able to do that because the films are distributed in homes and churches and schools and union halls, et cetera, et cetera.
And this is really a battle against corporatocracy really influencing our decisions in D.C. and
yes.
how the allocation of these funds. And for that matter, why we're there at all.
Well, we don't actually go into why we're there. I mean, some people will make the interpretation
right.
that this is an aspect of going into Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
What I tried to do with this stay with absolutely what I can prove factually. And what
right.
I can prove factually is Halliburton gives millions of dollars. Halliburton votes have been, any kind of vote to restrict Halliburton doesn't have a chance in hell. And we have concrete evidence of their profiteering.
Right. And you did this, and we talked about this in our last interview, which is so clever, which is to stay away from Hollywood corporatocracy, in essence. You go to the people directly. And you have, I assume, had some good success with people really coming on board with the donations and supporting this. Is this how it's gotten made?
Yes. In this particular case, we weren't able to raise the money, so we went out to people who bought the films, and we had about a week and a half, we had 3,000, 20, 30 people who contributed $25 and $50 each, which allowed the film to happen.
Right.
And it was quite astounding. And we actually had a screening, our first screening of the film was in Los Angeles in Santa Monica for hundreds of the people who had made this $25 and $50 contribution.
It is in theaters, right? It's in some major cities. It
so
has
it's
shown.
In New York.
And what are you planning on doing for theater distribution? Do you expect any? Do you expect wide distribution, or are you really going to the people more to do the home presentations, libraries, rec halls, etc.?
Well, we will have very wide distribution. Like Walmart, we had 7,000 screenings, but they were in homes and churches
right.
and schools, and we'll similarly have quite wide distribution of this. But again, I want alternative distribution because I want a discussion after every screening
Absolutely.
Rather than just walking out of the movie theater.
Right. So how can you, what do you have to say to people watching this as to how they can become involved over the next few months or so, ideally over the next month and a half before the election?
Well, we made it pretty simple and proactive, which is you go to iraqforsale.org, order a copy of the movie, look at the movie, and then you say, what am I going to do? I can join an organization, I can write a letter, I can call my congressman, or I can do a screening. The beauty of the film's content aside is it gives every one of us an opportunity to be active in a democracy. It gives us an opportunity to do something other than complain that we don't like the way things are going. It gives us an opportunity to go to our website and list the screening, and you can make it private, or you can open it up, and you can have friends and colleagues and schoolmates and people from work sign up. You can have strangers you don't know. We've had amazing experiences with people in the neighborhood, so we listed by zip code, so you go on, you put your zip in, and you can find out screenings are near you. I mean, it's truly a creation of the internet technology, but it allows everybody to do something. So the only area that I have zero patience is for people who say, oh, everything's so terrible, there's nothing I can do. That's nonsense. There are things you can do. And the film is a tool. It's only successful if you see it and do something. It's a complete failure if you see it and don't do anything.
Very true. If you don't mind my going into one of your experiences with the media, I saw you on Stephen Colbert. And you appealed to your support base as to, holy cow, I'm going up with this guy. What should I do? Any suggestions? I think I even wrote a suggestion. I'm sure you got thousands of them. How was it going with Stephen Colbert? He's so off the wall.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the program. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of him. I think he's just brilliant. And it's challenging because if you're going against a true right winger, you know what to do. You yell, you scream, you fight, you call each other names. But, you know, he's doing this brilliant thing where he's sort of a double agent.
Like a faux right winger.
Yeah. So it was a challenge, but it was a good challenge. And he's so smart and so quick. And
isn't
so
he clever?
Funny. Yeah.
I thought you held your own very well. Any plans of going around with him again on this one?
Probably it's too soon from their point of view because, you know, they like to have a year before they bring guests back.
So any you want to tease us a little bit, if you feel free to, of what's coming up next? I think you were working on this last time we saw you with the Walmart movie.
Well, this has pretty much taken the last living breath out of all of us. We need to finish it. We have a month and a half of hard work. I'm touring all next week, going city to city to city. And we have work of getting it out. Then we will stop and see where we are, deal with the challenges of fundraising, and look to the spring to see what our resources are. There's no lack of possibilities and no lack of subjects, and I actually would like to put some time and energy into doing short pieces, rapid response videos.
What does that mean, rapid response videos?
Well, the film takes a year, year and a half even, and that's fast. But I want to, if I can raise some funds and if I can get some groups behind us, I want a little guerrilla unit that would, something comes up in the news, in 24 hours you create a video.
Fabulous.
And you push it back out there. And we're in discussions, and I'm hopeful.
And you have the vehicle with the internet and streaming becoming as simple as it is for everybody now.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Pleasure.
I know you're a very busy man once again. And we'll see you next time after you get your guerrilla warfare going.
Okay. Thank you.
A great interview with Robert Greenwald about his new film, Iraq for Sale, The War Profiteers. And like I said before that interview, not only can you see that in tons of other interviews on ConsciousMediaNetwork.com, Iraq for Sale is going to be screening in Portland this Sunday night at 7 at Performance Works Northwest. And you can click through on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com, which is also the name of this show. My name's James. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.com. Thank you for listening. It's the November 17th episode of Media Monarchy. Jumping ahead to our next story, is John Bolton blackmailing those who'd vote him out of UN post? And this is coming from Wayne Madsen of WayneMadsenReport.com. If you listened to last week's episode, we had exclusive talk with Wayne Madsen recorded at the First Unitarian Church on November 1st here in Portland. Is John Bolton blackmailing those who'd vote him out of UN post? One of the signs that there is an intensive clash between the increasingly influential James Baker, Robert Gates, Brent Scowcroft group affiliated with George H.W. Bush and the remaining administration neocons centered around Vice President Dick Cheney is the battle to keep John Bolton at the UN mission The neocons in the administration are trying to come up with ways to keep Bolton in his position, even though the current Republican-led Senate Foreign Relations Committee, with the support of defeated Rhode Island Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee, does not look likely to approve Bolton's nomination. Incoming Chairman Joe Biden said as far as he is concerned, the Bolton nomination is dead. However, the neocons, including Cheney, are toying with the idea of appointing Bolton to the third-ranking position at the UN mission, which does not require Senate confirmation. By not filling the vacant ambassador position, Bolton would serve as an unconfirmed acting ambassador. It is well known that following Donald Rumsfeld's ouster at the Pentagon, that was something I missed, being off last week. That was great. I had a friend who said, hey, yeah, I voted, and who would have thought? Apparently, I woke up the next morning, and I voted out Donald Rumsfeld. It is well known that following Donald Rumsfeld's ouster at the Pentagon, Bolton is one of Cheney's sole remaining allies. Bolton is also vehemently anti-Iranian and opposed to the Baker-Hamilton Committee's outreach to Tehran. Therefore, it is important for Cheney to keep Bolton at the UN to rattle sabers at Iran. Bolton is also supported by the Israeli lobby in Washington that does not want to see any Washington-Tehran talks dedicated to working together on Iraq. There's also another wild card working in Bolton's favor. While he was at the State Department, Bolton gathered a number of NSA intercepts on U.S. persons and may be using their content to blackmail members of the administration and Congress to support his continued tenure at the UN. Wayne Mattson reported on Bolton's involvement in the NSA surveillance on May 15, 2005, and said, according to National Security Agency insiders, outgoing NSA Director General Michael Hayden, who's now at the CIA, approved special communications intercepts of phone conversations made by past and present U.S. government officials. The intercepts are at the height of the current controversy surrounding the nomination of Undersecretary of State John R. Bolton as ambassador to the United Nations. It was revealed by Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd during Bolton's Senate Foreign Relations Committee nomination hearing that Bolton requested transcripts of 10 NSA intercepts of conversations between named U.S. government officials and foreign persons. Later, it was revealed that U.S. companies, also treated as U.S. persons by the NSA, were also identified in an additional 9 intercepts requested by Bolton. However, NSA insiders report that Hayden approved special intercept operations on behalf of Bolton and had them masked as, quote, training missions in order to get around internal NSA regulations that normally prohibit such eavesdropping on U.S. citizens. Now, our next story on Media Monarchy was something I gave you the heads up on the last episode, to look for the DoubleTree video to come out before the election. That's one of the numerous, I think it's 84 or 86 videos that were confiscated by the FBI immediately after the attacks on the Pentagon on 9/11. There's a DoubleTree video, DoubleTree Hotel, that purports to possibly capture whatever hit the Pentagon, Flight 77, or who knows what. I told you that was going to come out right before the election. It was supposed to come out. It did not. And so the latest news, this coming from 9/11 blogger, the FBI has further delayed the release of a video that many bloggers have speculated may show the impact of Flight 77 into the Pentagon on September 11, 2001. That's not entirely true. We more speculate what didn't hit the Pentagon. Following last week's article detailing the imminent release of the DoubleTree Hotel video, a reader has informed us that after calling Judicial Watch, they were the ones putting in the FOIA request to get the videos released, after calling Judicial Watch and asking when the video would be made public, he was told, quote, the government said they needed more time, unquote. When asked when enough time would pass before they could release the tape, they said they didn't know and it was indefinite. Judicial Watch had previously announced that the video would be released before November the 9th and even speculated that it may be used as a political tool in order to sway midterm election votes. Ongoing FOIA requests and subsequent lawsuits should now have forced all unknown videotapes of the Pentagon attack out into the open. It seems that abiding by judicial law is something that the FBI refuses to be a part of, however. We're going to keep moving. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
Man, you hear this bullshit they be talking? Every day, man, it's like these motherfuckers is just like professional liars, you know what I'm saying? Wow. Listen.
Bin Laden didn't blow up the projects. It was your nigga. Tell the truth, nigga. fuck the president's speeches. I'm baptized by America and covered in leeches. The dirty water that bleaches your soul and your facial features, drowning you in propaganda that they spit through the speakers. And if you speak about the evil that the government does, the Patriot Act attract you to the type in your blood. They try to frame you and say you was trying to sell drugs and throw a federal indictment on niggas to show you love. Cause shit is run by fake Christians, fake politicians. Look at their mansions and look at the conditions you live in. All they talk about is terrorism on television. They tell you to listen, but they don't really tell you their mission. They funded Al-Qaeda, and now they blame the Muslim religion. Even though Bin Laden was a CIA tactician, they gave him billions of dollars, and they funded his purpose. Fahrenheit 9/11, that's just scratching the surface.
Bin Laden, blow up the project. It was show niggas, tell the show niggas. Bush knocked down the tower. Tell the show niggas. Bush knocked down the tower. Like, Bin Laden, blow up the project. It was show niggas.
Still fight for Saddam, but that's bullshit. I'll show you why it's totally wrong. Cause if another country invaded the hood tonight, it'd be warfare through Harlem and Washington Heights. I wouldn't be fighting for Bush or white America's dream. I'd be fighting for my people's survival and self-esteem. I wouldn't fight for racist churches from the south, my nigga. I'd be fighting to keep the occupation out, my nigga. You ever clock someone who talks shit for looking too wrong? Imagine if they shot at you and was raping your moms. And of course Saddam Hussein had chemical weapons. We sold them that shit after Ronald Reagan's election. Mercenary contractors fighting a new era. Corporate military banking off the war on terror. They controlling the ghetto with the fear of attack, trying to distract the fact that they engineering the crack. So I'm strapped like Lee Malvo holding a sniper rifle. These bullets will touch your kids, and I don't mean like Michael. Your body be sent to the morgue, stripped down and recycled. I fire on house niggas that support you and like you, cause innocent people get murdered in the struggle daily, and poor people never get shit and struggle daily. This ain't no alien conspiracy theory, this shit is real. Written on a dollar underneath the Masonic seal.
Immortal Technique and Mos Def with the track Bin Laden. You're listening to Media Monarchy. My name's James. We're on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com. And Media Monarchy is here every Friday at 10 a.m. or anytime you listen. Going to have podcasts up soon, hopefully real soon. You'll be able to listen anytime, and as the show starts to come together a little more and I can start to promote it a little more and I'll have podcasts and maybe have some flyers, everything will slowly pick up. It's kind of frustrating. I've had long-running shows on the East Coast when I worked radio there, and I think about the way the show was, you know, 5 years on, so it's tough starting back at the bottom, but it'll all come together, and with your help and listening and telling people about it and support, it'll come along even better. You can send me an email, mediamonarchy@yahoo.com. Want to touch on something a little local before I hit more news. There's a guy named Alex Ansari that has a show here on Portland Community Media called Outside the Box. He's got a webpage, alexansari.com. That's Alex, ANSARY.com. He does a show, Outside the Box, and he also posts the shows up every week to Google Video, and I try and do him a favor and post up a link to every new episode. The latest episode from last week, number 77, is up. It's on Thursday nights, so sometimes I'll be able to tell you about last night's episode. I don't think 78 is up yet, but you can always go and check it out. Alex does really great work. He's a great guy, really cool guy, young, energetic, thoughtful, insightful. He also has a show on the Republic Broadcasting Network, rbnlive.com. He's on the radio every day, and I think he may even be on right now. Yeah. Let's jump ahead to more news. Republicans propose last-minute spy bill. This is coming from ZDNet, and that's primarily a sort of tech news site, but because this relates to surveillance and spying, this is coming from ZDNet. The outgoing Republican chairman of a key U.S. Senate committee has made a last-minute attempt at giving the Bush administration what he calls the necessary, quote, resources for carrying out its phone call and internet surveillance within the law, but critics remain unconvinced. In remarks on the Senate floor on Tuesday afternoon, Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter, he of the single bullet theory, Arlen Specter marketed his new 11-page proposal as a, quote, significant advance in protecting civil liberties. Specter's new bill arrives less than a week after President Bush called on the lame duck Congress to prioritize legislation that would effectively authorize the administration's terrorist surveillance project, which is already the target of a few dozen lawsuits. The House of Representatives in September approved an administration-backed bill that drew fire from civil libertarians who argued it would expand the government's electronic spying powers to unprecedented levels. Titled the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Oversight and Resource Enhancement Act of 2006, the latest Specter bill does not appear to grant as much latitude for warrantless spying as the approved House bill. Specter's proposal, for instance, would require the U.S. Supreme Court to review all appeals of cases challenging the legality of the specific spy program acknowledged by the President last December, whereas the version approved by the House would effectively quash all such challenges. So basically, Specter offering up just a little bit of slightly less draconian measures. So it gives us the impression of some kind of debate, a phony debate. Our next story is a cool one and very informative, coming from the fantastic website Op-Ed News, the Carlyle White House. It was bad enough when the Carlyle Group bought Dunkin' Donuts last year, forcing millions of conscientious caffeine addicts to look elsewhere for their daily fix. Now it appears Carlyle has added 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to its formidable portfolio of acquisitions. The Carlyle Group achieved national attention in the early days of the Iraq occupation, especially after Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 exposed the firm's umbilical ties to the Bush family and the House of Saud. For the uninitiated, Carlyle is a privately owned equity firm organized and run by former members of the Reagan and Bush senior administrations. Currently, Carlyle manages more than $44 billion in 42 different investment funds, which is an interesting fact in and of itself. Carlyle could lay claim to only a meager $12 billion in funds in December of 2001. Thanks to their ownership of United Defense Industries, a major military contractor that sells a whole galaxy of weapon systems to the Pentagon, Carlyle's profits skyrocketed after the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Some notable present and former employees of Carlyle include former President George H.W. Bush, who resigned in 2003, James Baker III, Bush Sr. Secretary of State and King Fixer, and George W. Bush, who served on Carlyle's board of directors until his run for the Texas governorship. One notable former client of Carlyle was the Saudi Bin Laden Group, which sold its investments back to the firm a month after 9/11. Until the October 2001 sellout, Osama bin Laden himself had a financial interest in the same firm that employed the two presidents Bush. How has Carlyle managed to acquire the White House? The newest edition of Newsweek begins to tell the tale in a story titled The Rescue Squad. Bush Sr. has been relegated to watching all those political talk shows his son refuses to watch, wincing each time he hears his son's name being mocked or criticized. George H.W. Bush has been, in effect, sidelined by nepotism. He has reportedly told close friends that he does not believe it's appropriate or wise to second-guess his son or even offer advice beyond loving support. This time, however, was different. A source who declined to be identified discussing presidential confidences told Newsweek that Bush 41 left fingerprints on the Rumsfeld-Gates decision, though the father's exact role remains shrouded in speculation. Now, once again, that story is coming from Op-Ed News, and you can go to their page, opednews.com. The story that I just read through, I did mention every time there's a link, and you can read about the Carlyle Group. You can go to their own webpage and see the massive, massive, massive amounts of things that they have their, quote, fingerprints all over, Dunkin' Donuts being the least. What we're going to listen to now is a bit from a short, actually it's about 45 minutes. I'm not going to play the 45 minutes, I'm going to play 16 minutes. A bit about the Carlyle Group, it's on Google Video, it's on the webpage in this story about the Carlyle Group. Go to MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com for this and tons of other news. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.com. My name's James, thanks for listening. Let's jump to Iron Triangle, the Carlyle Group.
Carlyle is a massive private equity firm, and what a private equity firm does is essentially raise money from wealthy individuals and companies and funds, and then turns and invests that money in a slightly higher risk form of investing than, say, the stock market or the bond market.
What they do is they buy the stock directly from the company. They take ownership shares and often controlling shares, but they do not buy it on the public market. And they often have control of the companies they buy, which means that they do not have to, because the companies are privately owned, privately controlled, they don't have to, they're not subject to the securities exchange laws in this country.
They'll purchase the company for a fraction of what it's really worth, and then turn the company around and sell it off for a huge profit. It's called the buyout practice.
The list of knowledgeable institutional investors in aerospace defense is a fairly short list. And I think it would be widely acknowledged that at the top of that list is the Carlyle Group, located here in Washington, D.C., and considered by most people to be the premier investor in aerospace defense over quite a number of years.
What is new about Carlyle is the size and the dimension of their success. My understanding is they are now the 11th or 12th largest defense contractor, a multi-billion dollar annual enterprise with an almost obscenely high profit margin.
So please welcome Frank Finelli. Frank?
Well, super. It's great to be here back at the conferences that are put on here. As Jerry mentioned, the Carlyle Group, we're headquartered here in Washington, D.C. It's a global private equity merchant bank, and we probably do more leveraged buyout and venture capital investing related to defense and dual-use technology than any other private equity firm in the world. The defense industry valuation will grow primarily from two factors. One is that either the size of the defense pie gets bigger, as it has been over several years, or the slice of the pie related to that particular part of the defense industry gets bigger.
The Carlyle Group plays in industries and in an area that are heavily influenced by politics. And in order to do that effectively, they hire some of the best-known politicians from all over the world.
The first thing is, you know, where do the dollars go? What is the defense budget and what does it look like? This is the way it's commonly captured by the DOD controller. And there's roughly $380 billion in the FY04 defense budget that was recently submitted.
They hire defense experts like Frank Carlucci or Frank Finelli. They hire politicians like George Bush Sr. or James Baker III. And they hire businessmen, a number of, MBAs, Ivy League MBAs, you know, very, very bright business people from around the world.
Most people think about this topic as simply the Iron Triangle, the relationship of the Pentagon with Congress and industry. So I'm a practitioner who has been on all three sides of this triangle over the last 25 years or so, and it really has been a lot of fun.
The Iron Triangle is in some ways a uniquely American phenomenon. It's the confluence of the military, big business, and politics. And the combination of these three things is something that a number of U.S. presidents in the past have warned against. In particular, Dwight Eisenhower was very upfront about warning against the possibility of creating a military-industrial complex. By that, he means a group of a business built around defense and military that becomes so large and so powerful that it's actually able to influence the politics of war. Nothing sort of personifies that euphemism of the Iron Triangle better than the Carlyle Group. They have it all in one under one roof. Founded basically on a fluke. A couple of guys, this guy Steve Norris, who was a Marriott executive, got together with David Rubenstein, who was a former Carter aide. The two of them met frequently at a hotel in New York called the Carlyle Hotel. It's up on the Upper East Side. It's a beautiful, old, plush hotel.
I always liked Carlyle. It sounded English. It sounded old-worldly. It just seemed to have the right kind of ring to it.
So it was essentially, you know, this sort of fabricated legacy of sounding like they had a history of success and big money, old money.
And ultimately, at the end of the day, no one had a better idea.
But they decided, they made a very strange decision. They decided to base the company in Washington, D.C., which at the time, no one could really understand because all private equity firms of this nature were based in New York.
But as we talked to people about it, particularly some of the people that both David Rubenstein and I worked with, they thought we'd lost our minds. That it was too late, that what do we know about establishing a merchant banking business? I was a finance guy from Marriott, and David was a lawyer. But we had this dream to build a merchant bank, a private equity investment firm that could take capital and intermediate that capital into companies or real estate or venture capital. At the outset, we really didn't envision entirely where it might go. We saw it simply an opportunity to take advantage of Washington and the people here and the access that people had to transactions.
So to base the company in Washington, D.C. was a very strange decision, but as it turned out, it proved to be an extremely successful decision because of the direction that Carlyle eventually went in, which was to play in these very heavily government-regulated industries and to use ex-politicians to sort of pave the way for them.
We started buying shares of a company called Fairchild, which was here in the Washington area, because we thought it was very cheap.
And what kind of company was that?
It's a defense business. They had a satellite business, which we thought was very attractive and undervalued. And we invested in Fairchild. At one point, we had, I think, almost 25% of the company. Mm-hmm. And it was ultimately sold, and we made an enormous amount of money. And we began to see the opportunities in that area, and which is one of the reasons why, at the end of the Reagan administration, we were very interested in Frank Carlucci.
I will name as the next Secretary of Defense the best qualified man in America to carry on CAP's work, Frank Carlucci.
When Frank Carlucci came on board, he was coming straight from the Pentagon as Secretary of Defense. He had just, Reagan's term had just finished and Carlucci retired. He came on board and really took them in a completely new direction into defense. This was a time, bear in mind, where defense properties were worth almost nothing because the Cold War had just ended. And this huge military buildup that had taken place during the 80s had suddenly evaporated, which marked a great opportunity. And no one knew that better than Frank Carlucci, who had been in the Pentagon watching this whole trend happen firsthand. So Carlucci came on board and was able to take Carlyle 180 degrees in another direction. Sure enough, a year, 2 years later, the Gulf War hit. And everybody knows that wartime is boom time for the defense industry. So once the Gulf War hit, these properties skyrocketed again. And Carlyle made a ton of money. They did very, very well. They really cleaned up during that 3 or 4 year swing. And after that, Carlyle said, hey, you know, having these politicians on board is pretty great. I mean, they know things that nobody else knows. In fact, you know, Frank Carlucci was setting up policies while he was in office as Secretary of Defense that he's now capitalizing on as chairman of Carlyle Group. And, you know, it's a brilliant scheme if you think about it. You set up the policies, you leave office, you go into business, and then you exploit those policies. They picked up George Bush, James Baker.
Richard Darman is over there, who was a former budget director in the White House.
Arthur Levitt, the former SEC chairman. William Kennard, the former FCC chairman.
In Europe, you have former Prime Minister of England, John Major. Karl Otto Paul, from the head of the German Central Bank. Eberhard Kuhnheim, who is the chairman of the supervisory board of BMW, the Asia part. Former Prime Minister of Thailand, former President of the Philippines, Fidel Ramos, and at one point also the former Prime Minister of South Korea was on their board, a man named Mr. Park, who used to head up the largest steel company in South Korea.
The list just goes on and on and on. So these guys carry a tremendous amount of influence, and they are able to predict trends in global markets, predict trends in political shifts, and in some ways, and this is the sort of the most insidious part, and if you want to be cynical about the Carlyle Group, you have to be concerned about their ability to influence these trends and actually affect change in government policy which would positively affect their investments.
Former government officials tended, before Carlisle, to go to academic institutions, or they tended to, some just retired, or many of them became lobbyists. Mm-hmm. Well, for someone like Jim Baker, who really had been at the pinnacle of American power for over 10 years, he'd been chief of staff, he'd been secretary of the treasury, ultimately secretary of state, for Jim Baker to be a lobbyist or even to be a lawyer was not something that was terribly interesting in him.
If you're a Republican during a Democratic administration in the White House, for example, someone like James Baker, you're able to revolve out of the White House into the Carlisle Group, work there for a period of time, and then when that Democratic administration is through, like Clinton's was through in 2000, you're able to revolve right back into the White House. Colin Powell did that. Colin Powell did a little consulting for the Carlisle Group. He knows the guys very well. He knows Frank Carlucci very well. Frank Carlucci was his mentor as he came up through the ranks. And I think his relationship with the Carlisle Group personifies the gray area that the Carlisle Group works within. Some of these guys are never officially hired. You know, some of them are only put on retainer. Some of them are paid in very ambiguous ways, like through investments that they make through the Carlisle Group or the amount of money that they help raise, that kind of thing. So it's never really clear at any given time who exactly is working for the Carlisle Group. No one really knows unless, you know, they officially unless the Carlisle Group wants you to know. If the Carlisle Group wants you to know, then they put them up on the website and they put them in their brochures and that kind of thing. But if you look on the Carlisle website today, you don't see George Bush Sr.'s name anywhere, although he is working for the Carlisle Group. George Bush Sr. is a fundraiser. He is the kind of guy who can go into Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, where they love him, pack the house, and get these guys to open up their wallets and give money to the Carlisle Group. That's his role. But if you look in over the history of this company, George Bush Sr. has clearly met with business leaders one-on-one, met with political leaders in South Korea and in Saudi Arabia, and that would lead one to believe that he's doing much, much more than just giving speeches for the Carlisle Group.
So I got a call one day from Carlisle after I blasted them in the papers, and they said that maybe we should get together and talk. We had breakfast at the Mayflower Hotel. Everything was going very just fine. We were eating our eggs and bacon and talking about the weather. And then somewhere in the middle to the late part of the meal, he said, "How come you're trashing former President Bush?" And he said, "He's a very, very good, decent man. And, you know, I think it's really unfair what you've been doing about former President Bush." And I said, "Well, you know, all you have to do is tell the world what exactly he's doing for you." And I said, "What is he doing for you? And what's his position there? How much money did he make last year?" And he said, "Well, I can't tell you how much he made. He has no official position." And I said, "Yes, he does. He was the head of your business council in Asia. Last I checked, he still is." And he goes, "Well, that's just an advisory post." And he said, "He just gives speeches." And I go, "How much does he get a speech?" And I said, "I heard it's well over $100,000 every time he opens his mouth." And I said, "So if it's just a few speeches, why don't you just tell us where and when and how much? And then people like me will go away." And he said, "Well, that's not possible."
George Bush Sr. made it after he left the presidency. He was working for Carlisle and made several swings through East Asia, going to Thailand, going to South Korea and other places, sort of looking for investment opportunities for Carlisle. And Carlisle finally settled on South Korea. And then the way that overlaps with policy is during the Asia crisis, the International Monetary Fund came in with this rescue package for South Korea that the United States backed. And the U.S. used the IMF crisis to push through deregulation and changes in rules around foreign ownership, the changes that they'd been unable to press through, you know, maybe 25 or 30 years of trade policy. In a matter of months, under this IMF package, they just rammed all these changes through. And one of the changes was allowing foreign banks to take ownership shares, controlling shares of Korean banks. And so Carlyle has been right in there, and they bought one of the largest banks there, commercial banks. And so you can say that, you know, Bush Sr. didn't cut the deal, but when someone comes of that stature, that gives a kind of stamp of approval for, you know, people wondering, you know, who this investment group is. They say, well, it's backed by the former president of the United States, and it carries a lot of weight.
I have said that it's the worst kind of conflict of interest, particularly when your son is the president of the United States. So while Junior is talking to heads of state about war and other weighty matters, Papa is talking to them or having conversations with them about Carlyle. You know, and it's just, I find it disgusting.
The Iron Triangle and the Carlyle Group is the embodiment of the Iron Triangle. That's military, big business, and politics. We're into the second hour here on Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. My name's James. Thanks for listening. Jumping on to news, this next piece is coming from the hardworking folks at Infowars.com, and they're calling this one the Nuzzling Terror Cell. The insanity of Homeland Security enforced airline security measures reached a new high today as two American citizens were charged with violating the Patriot Act for, quote, sexual play on a Southwest Airlines flight from Los Angeles. Just when you thought it was safe to get back on a plane, just when you thought it may be possible to fly without fear of hijacking by liquid explosive baby milk wielding psychopath Islamofascist bent on destroying 400 airliners all at once, thus igniting atmospheric gases and triggering mass Armageddon all over the planet, you're wrong. You're wrong because now we must face the threat of the nuzzling terrorists. Carl Persing and Don Sewell, a couple in their early 40s, were observed nuzzling or kissing each other on the neck and allegedly engaging in more adult sexual acts. During these actions, Sewell was observed smiling, reads the indictment filed by the FBI. Oh no, not smiling as well. How could they? In all seriousness, however, this may at first seem like an isolated incident. Sadly, it is not. It is the latest in an unending series of examples of ludicrous airport and airline incidents that indicate the extent to which freedom of movement is under attack. It is the latest example in a long history of the use of the Patriot Act against lawful American citizens. And there's a link right on that sentence to read tons more, like we're going to get into. Persing and Sewell are facing up to 20 years in prison for violating legislation that, although unfairly passed, is supposed to be for use against those who commit or intend to commit terrorist acts. Today also saw a 65-year-old Australian man fined $10,000 under the United Nations anti-terrorism regulations by a Singapore court for uttering the word bomb on a flight to Indonesia. He was lucky he wasn't gunned down like the incident in Miami where Rigoberto Alpizar was shot on board an American Airlines Flight 924 for, quote, saying he had a bomb. Previous mind-boggling airport and airline incidents include a Wisconsin man who wrote, who was head of TSA, Kip Hawley is an idiot, on a plastic bag containing toiletries, was detained in September. An 83-year-old wheelchair-bound breast cancer, broken hip from a fall, and stroke victim was manhandled and treated to extra screening at Denver International Airport in April. Haraj Mann was reported to the British Airport Police for listening to a Clash record in a taxi on the way to the airport. The weasel driver was so frightened by some of the lyrics that he took them as a rallying call for a terrorist attack. A man was arrested in Portland Airport in December 2002 for becoming angry when security groped his pregnant wife and ordered her to strip in front of hundreds of other passengers. Passengers on a flight returning from Malaga, Spain, complained about two Asian men who thought they were potential suicide hijackers. The evidence? They were Asian. To the astonishment of the students, they were marched off the plane at gunpoint before it took off. On August 14th, a British Airways flight bound for New York was diverted back to Heathrow Airport because a mobile phone rang at the rear of the plane and its owner was not to be found. In August of this year, we saw the mother of all fake terror alerts used to beta test a system of total tyrannical control within airports where mothers carrying baby milk, as well as gel bra wearers, lip gloss users, and people who wear coats, and children who carry dolls, they were treated as possible terrorists. Several incidents have occurred where people who rely on medication have become ill or even fallen into comas because airport staff have refused to let them take medications on board. While a couple of weeks before, a tabloid reporter had planted a bomb, phony dummy bomb, on a nuclear waste train by just walking onto it, the British and American public were being ordered around, background checked, screened, and analyzed in any airport they entered. Similarly, test runs where terrorists smuggled dummy nuclear bombs across the U.S. border were being apprehended were successfully conducted by Glenn Spencer's American Border Patrol on three separate occasions. Airports and the general public, however, remain a focus of beefed-up security measures. Immediately after the very dubious plot details broke, the British government again attempted to ram through draconian detainee legislation, only to face a fierce backlash from the public who were sick and tired of being treated like mindless fools that believe anything they are told by their leaders. Airline companies, too, have viciously attacked the government. This week it was revealed that British Airways' terror alert bill has hit £100 million. It is now clear that anything anyone does in an airport or on a plane, including talking and kissing, is being categorized as possible terrorism. This is an excuse to implement the first stage of an agenda to create a two-tier caste system whereby only government-authorized citizens will be able to travel and everyone will be subject to intense airport-style harassment on city streets. Such idiotic excuses are being used every day to cram our lives with escalating security measures, biometric and body scans, lie detector tests, behavior analysis, facial analysis, and spot teams to spy on passengers. We are being acclimatized to these things, first within airports. Technology and measures that you don't even see used in prisons or high-security facilities are being passed off as completely normal in airports. Every indication suggests that there are moves afoot to implement these measures and methods into everyday life. A year ago, we were told that federal air marshals were to expand their work beyond airplanes, launching counter-terror surveillance at train stations and other mass transit facilities. So-called visible intermodal protection and response teams, or VIPER teams, may soon be permanently implemented on every transport facility. With no real threat to counter, such teams will busy themselves busting people selling tokens and herding people around like cattle in shock and awe programs, whatever the hell that term is supposed to mean now, prodding through transit scanners. We are told that an attack on transit systems within the U.S. is inevitable. In Canada, record levels of funding are now being poured into transit security to develop new surveillance networks, including cameras, develop risk assessments and security plans, and hire staff. Of course, this is necessary because despite the moves to totally crank up security on transit systems, Al-Qaeda has as their main targets. The airports are merely a beta test for the exact same measures to be rolled out in major cities, where regular checkpoint officials inspect internal passports and consumers are body scanned to enter a supermarket or any kind of public event as spy drones swoop overhead. The majority of what has been outlined is already being implemented at major transport and police hubs in the U.S. and Britain. When the technology to automate these measures is more widely used, its cost will drop and in turn spread like wildfire outside of the major cities and into local communities, unless we scream bloody murder and stop it before it makes it out of the airport terminal and onto our street corners and we all end up being categorized as suspects along with the nuzzling terrorists. And that's the nuzzling terror cell from Infowars.com. That story has tons and tons of links to all the things mentioned, linking to major media sources. You're listening to Media Monarchy. My name's James. You're listening to the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and you can hit this and all the news and views and videos and tons more on mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. We got about 45 minutes left. I'm going to do a whole blitz of news when I get back, but let's listen to Public Enemy.
From the bottom of hell, 'cause the black is back and is bound to sell. Picture us cooling out on the 4th of July, and if you heard we were celebrating, that's a worldwide lie. Yo, Chuck, the Fat Generals, man, trying to pull a 226 on you, G. Yo, man, show 'em what you got. Show 'em what you got.
This South is wild. Wait before you treat me like a stepchild. Let me tell you why they got me on file, 'cause I give you what you lack. Come right in next back.
am a rock hard tumor to the bone, a bone, a bone, full grown, consider me stone. Once again, and I say it for you to know, the troop is always ready. I am Geronimo, your CIA, you see I ain't kidding. Both K and X, they got rid of both. A story untold, true but unknown, Professor Griff knows.
Yo, I ain't no toast.
And not the bragging, I boast it, and plus it ain't no secret why the tap on my phone. And so I can't keep it a secret, so I decided to kick it, yo. And yes, it weighs a ton, I say it once again. I'm called an enemy, I'll never be a friend of those with closed minds. And know that I'm rapid, the way that I rap it is making a habit, yeah. Never serving a well, cause I'm an uncom. It's no secret at all. Checking my code, am I bugging? Cause they're bugging my phone for information. No telling who's selling that power, building the nation. So joining the set, dust, point blank target. Every brother's inside, so least not that you get no. Taking the blame is not a waste. Here takes a bit of a soul, so you can never be wrong. Just a bit of advice, cause we be paying a price. Cause every brother man's life is like swinging a dice, right? Here it is once again. This is the brother, the brother, the Terminator, the cutter. Going on and on, leave alone the groan. Get it straight in 88, and I'm trooping to demonstrate. The posse always ready, 98 and 98. My posse comes quick because my posse got a lot. And they tap on my phone, never leave me alone. I'm even lethal when I'm unarmed. Come and get some of this. I teach and speak, so when it's spoken, it's no joke. The voice of choice to play shakes with bass. Called War of the Treble. The rhythm is a rebel. Here's a funky rhyme that is tapping on. Just thinking I'm breaking the beats I'm rapping on. CIA, FBI, only tell us the lies. When I say it, they get alarmed. Cause I'm louder than a bomb.
Louder Than a Bomb, Public Enemy on Media Monarchy. You're listening to the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. My name's James. I'm your host and webmaster, web slinger. Next story, Abramoff to prison, coming from Reuters. Disgraced former lobbyist Jack Abramoff at the center of a political corruption scandal that contributed to the Republican loss of Congress in last week's elections began serving his prison sentence on Wednesday. The Federal Bureau of Prisons said Abramoff, who has been cooperating in the government's influence-peddling investigation, arrived at about 6:30 a.m. at a minimum-security federal prison camp in Cumberland, Maryland, 130 miles west of Washington. Now, I just moved about a year ago from right around there, and those of us around there in the know refer to Cumberland as Scumberland and many other terrible names, so I think that's a perfect place for Jack Abramoff to go. To Scumberland. There's links in that story. There's a lot of Wikipedia archives about the labyrinthine amount of scandals that Jack Abramoff is involved in. Moving on, I know something I wanted to hit last week, because it was coming up last week, now a little bit away from it. It was the fifth anniversary of the death of a man named William Cooper, author, radio host. His major book is called Behold a Pale Horse. He did a radio show for many, many years called Hour of the Time. You can find a lot of those shows floating around on the web. There's going to be a documentary made about William Cooper coming soon from one of his friends that worked with him very closely, right up until he was killed by federal agents on his own property on November 5th, 2001. So I grabbed one of the old recordings of William Cooper and put it to some music of Godspeed You Black Emperor. So I want to listen to this and think about William Cooper. I definitely suggest you go check out his book. You can probably even find a PDF of Behold a Pale Horse and tons of his radio shows, Hour of the Time. So let's listen to the late, great William Cooper discussing the genealogy of George H.W. Bush and the Skull and Bones.
Spurned by God in the form of the Vicar of Christ on Earth,
the Pope, and spurning God in their turn, the Knights Templars banded together in secret and formed what was to become known as Freemasonry. Now the legend goes that Freemasonry sprang up from ancient stonecutters' guilds and the men who built the stone buildings of the age. But Freemason actually comes from the French, Free Maison, which literally means the sons of light. Which light? Well, certainly in researching the problem, it is not the light of Christ. It is the light of the fallen angel of light. For when they were forsaken by the church, by Christ's vicar on earth, the Pope, they spurned God and turned to Lucifer. They held to the Luciferian philosophy that the gift of intellect by Lucifer through his agent Satan would in its turn make man God. These men were always on the run. They took the hidden Templar wealth and built a financial empire that stands to this day as the most powerful on the earth. Jews who had traditionally been persecuted throughout Europe flocked to the hidden temple. For there they could believe as they wished and worship whatever god they wished, for all were welcome. Many of the Templars running to ground flocked to England and to Scotland, where they fought for Robert the Bruce, who was engaged in an intense battle with the King of England. Now, let me regress just a little bit. King William the Lion, who was born in 1165 and died in 1214, had a daughter, Isabel of Scotland. Well, Isabel married a certain Robert Rose. Robert Rose was a Knight Templar who was heavily involved in the first efforts and was very successful at international banking. Plus, he established the first overt and covert international intelligence gathering organization, which all subsequent intelligence organizations have been based upon since. His son, Sir William Ruse, and his daughter, Lucy Ruse, figure prominently in the story to follow. Lucy married Sir Robert Plumpton. They sired two children, Sir William Plumpton and Alice Plumpton. During this period of time, this family, as the Knights Templar were going to ground, and the male progeny of this family always followed their father's footsteps and entered into the order, they established in secret the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry and may have had a significant role in the establishment, for intelligence reasons, of the order known as the Ancient Order of the Rose and Cross. Now, Alice Plumpton married Sir John Boteler. They gave birth to a daughter, Alice Boteler, who then married John Gerard, who had a child, Constance, who married Sir Alex Standish. The following children issued from that marriage: Ralph Standish, Sir Alex Standish, Roger Standish, and Alice Standish, who then married James Prescott. The children of this marriage were Roger Prescott, Ralph Prescott, John Prescott, and Captain Jonathan Prescott. Jonathan Prescott married Rebecca Buckley. They had two children, Abel Prescott and Lucy Prescott, and Lucy married Jonathan Fay. They sired three children, Samuel Prescott Phillips Fay, Samuel Howard Fay, and Harriet Eleanor Fay. Harriet married Reverend James Smith Bush, son of merchant Obadiah Bush. Their son, Samuel Prescott Bush, became the president of Buckeye Steel Castings Company of Ohio, a pioneer family of Franklin, Ohio, between Dayton and Cincinnati, and was one of the members of the Golden Circle, an order of the Quest, also known as the Jason Society, which gave issue to most of the political elite of the United States of America, who are, by the way, all, and I mean all without exception, related to each other. Now, Samuel Prescott Bush married, and his son Prescott Bush became a U.S. Senator from Connecticut, the director of Prudential Insurance, the director of CBS, a partner in Brown Brother Harriman, chairman National Republican Finance Committee, funds placed in Merrill Lynch accounts in Switzerland under the guidance of Donald Reagan. When he married, that marriage gave issue to the following: Prescott Bush II, an investment banker indicted for fraudulent banking practices; George Bush, chairman of Zapata Oil from 1963 to 64, chairman of the Republican Party, Harris County, Texas, when John F. Kennedy was killed; delegate to the GOP National Convention, 1964, 1968 member of the 90th and 91st Congress from Texas. From 1965 to 66, Nixon appointed Bush as ambassador to the United Nations to deal with China. He was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, chairman of the National GOP Party, vice president of the United States of America, and president of the United States of America. Four other children were William H. Bush, James Bush, Jonathan Bush, and Nancy, who married Alex Ellis. The issue of George and Barbara Bush was Dorothy, who married William LeBond, John Ellis Bush, Neil Bush, son of the director of CIA, becomes director of Silverado Savings and Loan and launders CIA drug money. Silverado loses over $100 million and Neil goes unpunished. And the two other children, Marvin Pierce Bush and George Bush II. Folks, this intelligence was gathered by one of our agents, codenamed John Galt, who spent literally years in dusty libraries and books of genealogy. And I'm not going to tell you which libraries or how he arrived at this information, but it has been checked. It is absolutely accurate. And this is just one portion of the pedigree of George Bush, who's literally related to most of the royal families of Europe. Now, you can have a copy of this chart if you want it. I'll tell you how to get it later, so have your pencils and paper ready. And I'm going to tell you exactly where the money goes. One half of the money goes to help pay for the airtime here. The other half goes to our agent, John Galt, to pay for the years of toil and dusty library books that nobody ever looks in, tracing genealogy. And folks, this is only one of the charts that he has furnished to us, along with others. Other agents of the Citizens Agency for Joint Intelligence who were engaged in the exact same research. And we have found that our most productive connections of the secret societies, the royal families, and what's happening in the world today is through genealogy. We have found a direct connection between the Peasants' Rebellion in England, the French Revolution, the Ronald Reagan and George Bush political campaign, and the George Bush political campaign. As far as the Peasants' Rebellion goes, the Encyclopedia Britannica calls it a, quote, curiously spontaneous rebellion. Barbara Tuchman, in her 14th century history, A Distant Mirror, said that the rebellion spread, quote, with some evidence of planning. Winston Churchill went even further. In his work, The Birth of Britain, he wrote, quote, throughout the summer of 1381, there was a general ferment. Beneath it all lay organization. Agents moved around the villages of central England in touch with a, quote, great society, unquote, which was said to meet in London. The spark of rebellion was being fanned vigorously, and finally the signal was given. Even though he had been arrested, excommunicated, and even now was a prisoner in the ecclesiastic prison at Maidstone in Kent, letters went out from priest John Ball and from other priests who followed him. Clerics were then the only literate class, so letters must have been received by local priests and were obviously intended to be shared with or read aloud to others. They all contained a signal to act now, which could put to rest the concept that the rebellion was simply a spontaneous convulsion of frustration that just happened to affect 100,000 Englishmen all at the same time. This from a letter from John Ball. In it he says, quote, John Ball, gritteth you well all and doth you to understand he hath rungen your bell. Now right and might, while and skyle, God speed every dale, which means ideal, now is time, unquote. From priest Jake Carter, quote, you have great need to take God with you in all your deeds, for now is time to be war, unquote. From priest Jake Truman, quote, Jake Truman, doth you to understand that falseness and guile have reigned too long, and truth hath been set under a lock, and falseness reigneth in every flock. God do both, for now is time, unquote. Now you'll notice that in every one of those quotes, there was one phrase that stands out, and that phrase is, now is time. One letter from John Ball, quote, St. Mary Priest, unquote, is worth quoting in its entirety. Even with the medieval English spelling, the meaning will be clear. Lechery and gluttony were frequent points in his accusations of high church leaders. Quote, John Ball sent Mary Priest greats well all manner men, bides him the name of the Trinity. Father and Son and Holy Ghost stand mainly together in truth and help is truth, and truth shall help you. Now reigneth pride in prize, and covetous is hold, wise and lechery, withouten shame, and gluttony withouten blame. Envy reigneth with treason, and sloth is take in great season. God do both, for now is time. Amen. Unquote. Now, folks, if you research the history of the French Revolution, you will hear that the spark, the word that spread through the country like wildfire, that ignited the rebellion in France, was, quote, now is the time. Literally the same phrase. Some say that in the American Revolution the same phrase was heard, and we find mention of it in several texts, but not like it was heard in the Peasants' Revolt in England, and not like it was heard in the French Revolution. But it was heard again in modern times. It was the campaign slogan of the Bush-Reagan campaign, and was used again in the Bush campaign. Now is the time. Now is the time. One famous photograph, staged by George Bush and selected by George Bush for publication in Life magazine, shows him lying in bed holding the pyramid with the capstone in place, signaling to Masons, Freemasons, and members, the priests of the mystery schools around the world, that he is the one who will bring into fruition their ages, centuries, millennia-old dream of the new world order. In our search for the Templars, we have followed them right to their gravestones. And on some of their gravestones, it shows the knight leaning back, reclining, with his feet resting upon a dog, denoting that he is the master. On most of the tombstones, however, we have found something unexpected. The skull and crossbones. Now, when the Knights Templars were persecuted, the fleet, they had vast fleets, an entire navy, disappeared. And no one, at least no one in the establishment historian group, claims to know where they went. But we have found them, folks. They became the pirates and hoisted their symbol of the skull and bones to the yardarm. They became the vast fleet of pirates who roamed the seas of the world and terrorized nations, navies, and merchantmen. And thus arose, from the initiation rights of the Templars, the initiatory rites of crossing the equator, the international date line, and others, and accounts for the Brotherhood amongst the pirates of the world, even to establishing seaports that they owned and operated and where they could always find safety. Those in the land established what they called the Brotherhood of Death. Chapters were formed throughout the world. George Bush was initiated in the crypt, or what is known as the tomb, at Yale, into the Brotherhood of Death, also known as the Russell Crust, also known as the Skull and Bones. The research of many people have revealed what the interior of the crypt, or what is known as the tomb, at Yale, the fraternity house of the Bonesmen, contained. And Anthony C. Sutton, in his monumental work, America's Secret Establishment, all about the Skull and Bones, and one other who wrote a magazine article and published it, reveal the initiation ceremony, revealed that swastikas were found inside the tomb, revealed that the altar is a pile of bones, and that the secret ceremony that George Bush underwent during his initiation was thus. On the day of his initiation, George Bush was conducted through a long, dark passage into an immense hall draped with black. He was able to see by the faint light of sepulchral lamps, corpses in their shrouds. The altar, built of human skeletons, stood in the center. Ghostly forms moved through the hall, leaving behind them a foul odor. At length, two men dressed as specters appeared and tied a pink band of ribbon smeared with blood around his forehead. Upon this was an image of the Lady of Loreto. A crucifix was placed in his hand and an amulet hung around his neck. His clothes were removed and laid upon a funeral pyre in a fireplace, while upon his body crosses were smeared in blood. Then his pedunca were tied with string, that's his genitals. Now five horrid and frightening figures, blood-stained and mumbling, approached him and threw themselves down in prayer. After an hour, sounds of weeping were heard. The funeral pyre started to burn, and his clothes were consumed. From the flames of this fire, a huge and almost transparent form arose, while the five prostrate figures went into terrible convulsions. Now came the voice of an invisible hierophant booming from somewhere below as George Bush lay in a coffin naked. The words were those of these oaths which the candidate had to repeat. Quote, "In the name of the crucified one, I swear to sever all bonds which unite me with mother, brothers, sisters, wife, relatives, friends, mistress, kings, superiors, benefactors, or any other man to whom I have promised faith, service, or obedience. I name the place in which I was born. Henceforth, I live in another dimension, which I will not reach until I have renounced the evil globe which has been cursed by heaven. From now onwards, I shall reveal to my new chief all that I have heard or found out, and I shall also seek out and observe things which might otherwise have escaped me. I honor the Aqua Tofana. It is a quick and essential medium of removing from the earth, through death or robbing them of their wits, of those who oppose truth and those who try to take it from our hands. I shall avoid Spain, Naples, and all other accursed lands, and I shall avoid the temptation to betray what I now have heard. Lightning will not strike as rapidly as the dagger, which will reach me wherever I may be, should I betray my initiation." Unquote. Now a candelabrum bearing seven black candles is placed before the candidate, and also a bowl containing what is supposed to be human blood. He washes himself in the blood and drinks a quantity of it. The string around his genitalia is removed. He is placed in a bath to undergo complete ablution. After this, he eats a meal composed of vegetables. At this time, he is given his new name, by which he will be known to all of the others in the order, the Brotherhood of Death. And with the completion of his initiation, George Bush joined all of the male members of his family in a long line of ancestry traced from Robert Bruce to the modern day. He took his place in the order, the Knights Templar, Freemasonry, and has worked diligently to fulfill his role in the completion of the plan, the great work, the formation of the New World Order, the one world totalitarian socialist state, the destruction of all existing nation states, all existing religions, and enslavement of the mob. The very highest degrees of the order show that the rationalism and materialism of the thinkers who developed it were determined to stamp out belief in religion. God and any faith in a deity, the initiate was told, were human inventions and had no real meaning. Subsequently, this was developed further, and the member who arrived at the highest position, that of Rex or King, learned that he was now equal to a king and that all men were capable of equal advancement. Hence the need for kings over ordinary mortals was an illusion, and at the highest rank the title of Rex Mundi, or King of the World, is assumed.
The late, great William Cooper, speaking over top of Godspeed You Black Emperor. William Cooper, I definitely recommend you go seek him out. His book, Behold a Pale Horse, or tons of his radio shows, Hour of the Time. Last week saw the 5th anniversary of his death, shot down on his own property by federal agents. The late, great William Cooper. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, and mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. My name's James. We've got about 20, 15 minutes left. I'm going to bust through some more news. And just as Mr. Cooper was speaking about the plan, it continues. Bush prepares to impose martial law, and this is coming from the Chattanoogan. The Republican rewriting of the Insurrection Act gives Bush the authority to declare martial law. For the first time since 1878, the president has the power to deploy troops within the United States. Bush and future presidents now have a power that, in other countries, is reserved to the dictator. Despite the unprecedented and shocking nature of this new law, there has been no outcry in the American media and little reaction from our elected officials in Congress. The Insurrection Act had historically, along with the Posse Comitatus Act, prohibited military involvement in domestic law enforcement. Now, Public Law 109-364, or the John Warner Defense Authorization Act of 2007, and that's H.R. 5122, and I've got a link to the whole bill on Media Monarchy. Now, the John Warner Defense Authorization Act of 2007 allows the president to declare a public emergency, station troops anywhere in America, and take control of state-based National Guard units without the consent of the governor. That's from the Chattanoogan, and then the accompanying piece was written by Father Frank Morales, an Episcopal priest and longtime activist. You can also listen to an interview with him on the page, posted on SF Indie Media. In a stealth maneuver, President Bush has signed into law a provision which, according to Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, will actually encourage the president to declare federal martial law. President Bush seized this unprecedented power on the very same day that he signed the equally odious Military Commissions Act of 2006. In a sense, the two laws complement one another. One allows for torture and detention abroad, while the other seeks to enforce acquiescence at home, preparing to order the military onto the streets of America. Remember, the term for putting an area under military law enforcement control is precise. The term is martial law. The law also facilitates militarized police roundups and detention of protesters, so-called illegal aliens, potential terrorists, and other undesirables for detention in facilities already contracted for and under construction by Halliburton. That was in the Houston Chronicle. That's right, under the cover of a trumped-up immigration emergency and the frenzied militarization of the southern border, detention camps are being constructed right under our noses, camps designed for anyone who resists the foreign and domestic agenda of the Bush administration. And one bit of news that I would have covered last week, the well-timed Saddam guilty verdict came just 48 hours before the election, which I suppose turned out all right. The Genoveses won over the Gambinos. I've got a clip here of Saddam being sentenced from the AP. Let's see if I can rock that clip. And I also have an accompanying story from Reuters. An Iraqi court sentenced a shaken but defiant Saddam Hussein to hang on Sunday for crimes against humanity, sparking joy for Shiite oppressed and resentment among his fellow Sunnis across Iraq's violent sectarian divide. As mortar rounds crashed on warring Baghdad neighborhoods and police reported sporadic clashes despite a curfew on the capital, Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki called for unity after the ousted leader was handed the punishment he deserves. The United States, which set up the court after its invasion, toppled Saddam in 2003, called it a good day for the Iraqi people. U.S. officials again dismissed charges. The verdict was timed to aid President George W. Bush's Republicans at elections on Tuesday that have been dominated by dismay at Iraq's turmoil. Defense lawyers, who said they saw little hope from an appeal in the coming months, dismissed it as a victor's justice. Saddam, 69, initially refused to stand when brought in to hear the verdict from Kurdish Chief Judge Rauf Abdul Rahman at a quick-fire 45-minute hearing. When he did, shakily, with clear emotion, he yelled the defiant Arab battle cry, "Allah Akbar, God is greatest, and long live Iraq," as the judgment was read. Last news story I'll hit today, coming from Business Online, a global database to monitor travelers entering and leaving the European Union and the United States is being tested in Britain and America. The project for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security would create a global identity database using biometric identification such as digital fingerprinting. People involved in the trial say it could be extended to include countries such as Canada. Troy Potter, biometrics manager for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Border Control Program, told the business, "Early stage discussions about what we should be doing to make biometric information sharing happen are currently taking place between like-minded countries such as Britain and other EU members. The task of checking the biometric data of hundreds of millions of European and American citizens is enormous. The trials will establish whether it's technically feasible to build such a network." And that story's on Media Monarchy, biometric ID database set for global takeover. You're listening to Media Monarchy on the Portland Radio Authority. My name's James. You can get this and tons of other news and stories and videos on MediaMonarchy.blogspot.com. And you're listening right now to PRARadio.com. Want to hit maybe just the last couple things that I didn't get to hit last week while I still have a little bit of time left.
Ha ha ha! Foolish earthlings! Now is the perfect time to strike! They'll think it's another hoax!
Lisa, that was just a radio show.
Paul?
Please, you must believe me. This is no hoax. This is a real invasion.
Colonel King, your report?
Well, the Earthlings continue to resent our presence. You said we'd be greeted as liberators.
Don't worry. We still have the people's hearts and minds.
I don't know. I'm starting to think Operation Enduring Occupation was a bad idea.
We had to invade. They were working on weapons of mass disintegration.
Sure they were.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart.
You can roughly locate any community in the world somewhere along a scale running all the way from democracy to despotism. One to the democracy end, another somewhere in the middle, and a third. Let's find out about despotism. This man makes it his job to study these things.
Well, for one thing, avoid the comfortable idea that the mere form of government can of itself safeguard a nation against despotism. Germany, under President Hindenburg, was a republic. And yet in this republic, an aggressive despotism took root and flourished under Adolf Hitler. When a competent observer looks for signs of despotism in a community, he looks beyond fine words and noble phrases.
One nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Many observers have found that two workable yardsticks help in discovering how near a community is to despotism: the respect scale and the power scale.
A careful observer can use a respect scale to find how many citizens get an even break. As a community moves towards despotism, respect is restricted to fewer people. A community is low on a respect scale if common courtesy is withheld from large groups of people on account of their political attitudes. If people are rude to others because they think their wealth and position gives them that right, or because they don't like a man's race or his religion. Equal opportunity for all citizens to develop useful skills is one basis for rating a community on a respect scale. The opportunity to develop useful skills is important, but not enough. The equally important opportunity to put skills to use is a further test on a respect scale. A power scale is another important yardstick of despotism. It gauges the citizen's share in making the community's decisions. Communities which concentrate decision-making in a few hands rate low on a power scale and are moving towards despotism. Like France under the Bourbons, one of whom said, "The state, I hate." Today, democracy can ebb away to citizens allow power to become concentrated in the hands of bosses.
What I say goes, see? I'm the law around here.
The test of despotic power is that it can disregard the will of the people. It rules without the consent of the governed. Look beyond the legal formalities of an election in measuring a community on the power scale, to see if the ballot is real. If the citizens can vote only the way they're told, a community approaches despotism. When legislators become ceremonial assemblies only, and have no real control over lawmaking, their community rates low on a power scale. In a downright despotism, opposition is dangerous whether the despotism is official or whether it is unofficial.
The spread of respect and power in a community is influenced by skills which many observers measure by means of the economic distribution and information scales.
If a community's economic distribution becomes slanted, its middle income groups grow smaller, and despotism stands a better chance to gain a foothold. Where land is privately owned, one sign of a poor economy is the concentration of land ownership in the hands of a very small number of people. When farmers lose their farms, they lose their independence. This one can stay on, but not as his own boss anymore. To the extent that this nation exists throughout a nation, the likelihood of despotism is increased. Communities which depend almost entirely on a single industry, such as factory or mining balance, is a challenging problem, and exists over them as a whole, so that the control of jobs and business opportunities is in a few hands, despotism stands a good chance. Another sign of a poorly balanced economy is the taxation system that presses heaviest on those least able to pay. A larger part of a small income is spent on necessities such as food. Sales taxes on such necessities hit the small income harder. In the days of the salt, feudalisms were partly sustained by this and other effects. A community rates low on an information scale when the press, radio, and other channels of communication are controlled by only a few people, and when citizens have to accept what they are told. In communities of this kind, despotism stands a good chance. See how a community trains its teachers.
Bear this in mind. Young people cannot be trusted to form their own opinion. This business about open-mindedness is nonsense. It's a waste of time trying to teach students to think for themselves. It's our job to tell them.
And teachers put into practice, despotism stands a good chance. These children are being taught to act uncritically. Whatever they're told is earned and encouraged.
How can you question? Have you got a textbook?
Yes, ma'am.
That's that our law courts always just?
Ma'am.
How dare you question the fact? Sit down.
And so we aren't surprised when...
But it must be true. I saw it right here.
And if books and newspapers and the radio are efficiently controlled, the people will read and accept exactly what the few in control want them to. Government censorship is one form of control. A newspaper which breaks government rule can... It is also possible for newspapers and other forms of communication to be controlled by private interests.
I thought I told you to kill that story. It'll cost us a lot of advertising.
If that story goes out, I quit.
All right. What sort of community do you live in? Where would you place it on a democracy-despotism scale? To find out, you can rate it on a respect scale and a power scale. And to find out what way it is likely to go in the future, you can rate it on economic distribution and information scales. The lower your community rates on economic distribution and information scales, the lower it is likely to rate on respect and power scales, and thus to approach despotism. What happens in a single community is the problem of its own citizens. But it is also the problem of us all. Because as communities go, so goes the nation.
That's a scratchy old video from 1946 from Encyclopedia Britannica Films, and that's called Despotism. And I think it neatly sums up what turns out to be the theme of the episode, as corporate control and politics of war. You've been listening to Media Monarchy. My name's James. I thank you for listening. We're on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.com, every Friday at 10 a.m. And as I get podcast rolling, a little more promotion, I will let you know for sure. So that's going to do it for this episode for November 17th, 2006. I urge you to check out the page. I urge you to not to hate the media, but to become the media, as old Jello Biafra once said. So thanks for listening to Media Monarchy. Check out mediamonarchy.blogspot.com. Until next time, my name's James. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.